Hello everyone, herb lovers, sustainable health seekers, herbal medicine fans. Welcome back to Herbcast, our podcast from Herbal Reality. In every episode, we explore how traditional wisdom and up-to-date herbal science can meet the needs of the hour and support a sustainable and effective approach to our health. As you know, herbs have nourished human health for thousands of years, and whilst they hold so much potential to meet today's numerous health challenges, there are still so many questions to be answered. And we're delighted to have you with us today as we continue to deepen our understanding together. So get comfy, pour yourself a cup of herbal tea, and let's begin. Today's episode is hosted by Simon Mills.
Welcome, everybody. This has really been a session I've been looking forward to more than any other. I've been working with Chris now for, 20 years, and have always been working on the professional side of the business. But this is the first time I've really sat down and had a decent conversation with Chris about what we do together and what we each do in our practices with patients. And I'm impressed what Chris brings to the party. And so I'm hoping to be able to share some of this and to tackle some of the more challenging work that we do in the practice with Chris's help. So welcome, Chris.
Oh, thank you, Simon. It's wonderful to actually, as you say, sit down and have a talk with you about just herbal medicine matters for a change.
How did you get to here? Looking at your story so far, it's a pretty impressive one. Where did you start this journey?
It's been a bit of a long circular route to get to herbal medicine, but it's fascinating looking back, I think, and seeing what's interested me in the past and where that passion has led to me being where I am today. As many of us can, I think, relate to, I think that the main push that got me interested in herbal medicine was actually my grandmother. So she used to have a fantastically big garden, and she used to grow lots of herbs there. And she used to use them as well, which is kind of fantastic, isn't it? So this is in the 1970s when I was kind of growing up, a small boy, maybe sort of 3-4 year old. I can just remember those wonderful halcyon summers, you know, long days of warmth and sunshine, helping my grandmother in her garden. She'd have all rows of lemon balm and peppermint and sage and rosemary there, and we would just pop around the garden, and she'll just be doing the weeding, and then suddenly say, "No, Christopher, that's not a weed, that's one of my herbs, don't pull it up." And then I sort of squeeze it and say, "Well, what, that smells lovely, what's that?" And she'd say, "Well, that's lemon balm, and I like to take that for me or granddad when we've got a bit of a nervous tummy, or we're feeling a bit sort of anxious or something." So from an early age, I would always go and pick things from her for the garden. She'd say, I fancy a peppermint and lemon balm tea, can you go out in the garden and get those for me? So I'd kind of pot around my little pot and just pick little sprigs and then take them into the house for her, and then we'll brew a big pot of herbal tea, and then we'll sit down and drink it all together, which was just absolutely fabulous.
The important thing is that early few years, isn't it?
It is, and just the it's that organoleptic, isn't it? It's the smell, the taste, feeling the effects it has on the body. And, you know, and she just had a fabulous garden. She had a lovely walnut tree, so I used to always love collecting the walnuts and getting my hands all wonderfully black with the wonderful, wonderful dye compounds in there, which of course we use in practice. And she just loved elder. So we used to harvest elder flowers in the spring and make elder flower fritters. And then she used to make elder flower wine, which I still think is one of the best herbal medicines there is. And of course, in the autumn, we would harvest the elderberries and make elderberry wine, which, again, another wonderful herbal medicine. So that really, really intrigued me in the sort of the quest to know more about the chemicals inside all these wonderful plants, all the tastes, the smells, the actions. And so I was always passionate, really, from then on. I always, from a young age, had a little herb garden and would grow my own little herbs. And that I kept going with that, really, through all my life. There hasn't been a time when I haven't grown herbs. But primarily, I think this really focused me into an interest in chemistry, because I wanted to know about what these compounds were and, you know, how they worked. And that sort of really focused me during my O-levels and A-levels. In chemistry, I had a wonderful chemistry teacher who was really interested in natural products too. So she really helped me every step of the way. And I owe a lot to Mrs. Davis, she's a fantastic, fantastic mentor she was. And yeah, that pushed me into going into studying chemistry for my Bachelor of Science honours at Imperial College. And again, I can remember my first term there, picking up this wonderful, wonderful organic textbook, Introduction to Organic Chemistry by Streitwiser and Heathcock. Wonderful, huge, purple-covered tome. And it's just all the natural chemistry in their natural products. And I can remember turning to one page and seeing Nut Ketone. And it's the odour of grapefruit and the, what is it, and the Alaskan yellow cedar. And it's just always wonderfully evocative names and uses. And that really propagated me a long way to specialise in organic chemistry, particularly natural product chemistry. That led to me going to my PhD in medicinal chemistry and working through that, moving into my research fellowship and lectureship at Imperial, working in natural products in a medicinal side. I think, like most people in research, and academia, once you have a certain amount of time there, it can be rather overloading. And I think I reached a point of burnout where I was spending more time filling in funding application forms rather than doing anything else. So I decided to leave and retrain. And I didn't know what I was going to do. But strangely enough, I was in London in Waterstones, and I saw this fabulous book that just really inspired me, and it was, of course, something you're familiar with. It was this old wonderful source of information. But I bought that, and I'm very sad to say I read it cover to cover in about a week.
I don't think we did that. I read mine, and Kerry read his.
But it did. It inspired me, because what was interesting is because I always thought that herb medicine was kind of like a bit of a, you know, it wasn't a real thing. It was something that people dabbled with. You know, it was something from the past. This was modern herbal medicine, so it had the basis in science, and that's what really fascinated me. So that really pushed me to think about this as a career, and I registered with the dear old College of Phytotherapy in Battle. So that was 2002. I started there, finished there in July 2006, and have been practicing ever since as a herbalist.
20 years or counting. Yeah,
absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
And you've got a couple of practices, have you?
Yep. I've got a practice in London and a practice in Epping. In the practice in London, I mainly work with supporting patients with cancer. So in very integrated practice, working with oncologists, haematologists, surgeons, etc., just to really see what we can do to get the best results for the patient in their recovery. And with my Epping practice, yes, I see some cancer patients here, but I have that more as a general practice where I see other health conditions outside of the cancer label.
I know you do an enormous amount of work more widely in the herbal professional side and with the British Herbal Medicine Association and other things. So I dare say your life is still as full as it ever was.
You know, you know that those wonderful people at the circus who are doing the plate juggling and they have sort of multiple, yes, multiple plates juggling on their head and their sticks and everywhere else. I feel like I've got a lot of plates juggling all the time, and you have to kind of watch what you're doing, otherwise one's going to drop. But
well, one of my main gratitude for you is that you've taken over many of the plate jugglings that I once used to have. So I do know exactly how it is, and I salute you for taking that on, and much more so than I ever did. So.
Well, it's a wonderful privilege. I mean, working with all the different people is just it's so inspiring. And you know, it's with all the different things I do, it's a real honour, because I really love it, and I love the challenges.
It comes through, yeah.
And I love doing different things every day. So it's just, you know, no day is ever the same for me, which is just it's just wonderful.
It's the passion that differentiates this from other work that is done. I mean, you've got that in spades. So thank you again for coming along on this journey we are on, and to bring all that expertise that you've accumulated in time, and that, as you say, working in oncology is particularly demanding for us. And I think you've got some stories that illustrate perhaps some of the work you do with, I think you have some case studies there, don't you, Chris? I mean, do you want to, how do you want to do this? Do you want to just start with a story and see where it leads? And
let's do that. And you can stop me if I'm getting off track. I mean, so yeah, let me start perhaps with quite a complex case, Simon. It wasn't actually, in this case, a patient that I'd seen for support during cancer. It's actually, I saw them after they'd been treated conventionally for cancer. So they'd had a history of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma in their duodenum. They'd had to have quite strong chemotherapy and radiotherapy, which thankfully completely cured of them of cancer. So they're completely in remission and have been so for 15 years or so now. But the main problem was this patient kept on getting what initially the doctors thought was kind of acute pancreatitis in a sort of a cyclical way, but didn't respond to treatment. The patient was in absolutely terrible, terrible pain. You know, all the classic symptoms, you know, that would suggest pancreatitis, but really no signs of any pancreatic issues. When they looked, they could see perhaps the radiation beam had grazed the pancreas and had caused some issue. But they really didn't want to know what to do because the patient couldn't take any of the major pain medication because she just couldn't. They just made her really, really sick, ill, and hallucinate. So she couldn't have those. So it just kept on reoccurring at sort of monthly intervals. And doctors scratched their heads and just said, well, we think you've got possibly sphincter of Oddi dysfunction, which is now called biliary sphincter disorder, just where there's, you know, spasming and as it says, you know, the sphincter just doesn't work properly, which causes this horrible, you know, colic-like pain that's unbearable. So, you know, she had a pretty unremarkable history. She was very fit and healthy. You know, she was an amateur athlete in the past. So there's none of the sort of other issues we might consider here. And I immediately, when I saw her, took her case history, examined her, again, couldn't find anything of note. So I pushed her on to a kind of a, what I considered would be a supportive regime moving forward. So I wanted to work on her diet because I'm a huge fan of nutrition. I've done an MSc in nutrition as well. So I think that the diet is really the foundation stone of any treatment, be it orthodox or complementary. I think it's really important. So I put on a low fat, relatively high protein, low carbohydrate diet. I gave her some lovely supplements, which we could argue are herbal medicines, and I do. I gave her an aloe vera juice to drink, because I think that's just one of the best things for the gut, reducing inflammation, some fish oil, magnesium, etc., a multivitamin probiotic. For the dear old microbiome, of course, because who doesn't need their microbiome helped?
Especially in that situation.
Oh, exactly, absolutely. Mm. And then I gave a sort of a two-pronged attack. I really thought that she needed, obviously, some daily help to reduce inflammation, to help kind of the whole pancreatic, liver, gallbladder axis. But also I wanted to give her some acute pain mix because it's that acute pain that was really affecting her. So I initially put her onto a mix with wild yam, Dioscorea villosa, and a schedule 20, Lobelia inflata. The dear old mother of the gut, Matricaria chamomilla, German chamomile, which I think is an obvious one, but a really powerful one. Chinese magnolia vine, Schizandra chinensis. And a herb that I think is underused still, and that's vervain, Verbena officinalis. I think it's a wonderful herb.
I use it a lot, yes.
Yeah, but a lot of practitioners don't. But I think it's a real powerful herb. It's great. So I gave her this, and it was a regular, so 105 mils per week, 5 mils TDS, or 7.5 mils BID if she preferred, mix. And I gave her an acute mix as well to take when she had one of these colic pain spasm attacks.
And what was
again,
that?
An interesting mix. I, subscribing to the Kerry Bone School of Pain Management, I had a mix of Corydalis ambigua, Gelsemium sempervirens, yellow jasmine. I had some more lobelia in there as well, but making sure the total daily wouldn't go over the Schedule 20 Part 2 allowance, of course. Some crambark, of course, Viburnum opulus, one of the dear herbs, and some ginger, zingiba, again, just for its relaxant and a elbow, effect. And I think the dose of that was 40 drops up to 8 times a day if you needed that in warm water. And had really quite spectacular results. Within 1 week, the patient felt incredibly much better. Her digestion was working better. She had no problems at all. I saw her again, I think sort of 4 weeks later. Again, all was working well. She'd had some pain. She'd taken the pain mix and it worked. She had to use just take it once and it just knocked the symptoms on the head. And so we continued with the same herbs. I don't usually stay on the same herbs, but they were working for her.
Yeah.
And we kept on them for something 6 months and everything was stable and she was fine. So I said, well, okay, it looks like everything's okay. Let's try reducing the dose of the main mix slightly down to, 5 mils twice a day. And as soon as she did that, whether it was psychosomatic or whether it were or not, she immediately began to feel the symptoms coming back again. So we popped up the dose again and everything was fine. Left it another couple of months, tried reducing the dose, and the same thing happened again. We've kept her on the same mix since 2019. And she takes it religiously every month. She hasn't had to use the pain mix at all since taking this regularly.
That's the important point, isn't it?
Yeah, and everything is going really, really well. But it shows that sort of multi-prong attack, I think, works well.
Yeah. So interesting, because I was thinking about your mix there. I mean, it's not as if you're going hard into the inflammatory element. It sounds more like you're sort of reducing spasm. I mean... Mm. Talk us through the wild yam and what was your thinking there?
Well, it is an anti-inflammatory. It's a gut relaxant. It's a nervine tonic.
That's what I think of it as.
It's a liver stimulant, and I think that's where it really works. Well, I do find that the number of inflammatory gut issues, wild yam works really well. And I know if you read some of the contraindications, it contains the triterpene saponin, so it can cause, reflux irritation if somebody's prone to acid reflux or indigestion or sort of digestive irritation. But I find it works really, really well.
Yes, I'm very fond of it, yeah.
Yeah, I just think it's a really potent herb. You know, it has so many different uses aside from this. And I did think that, I did wonder as well, because the patient was sort of a menopausal age, I wondered if some of the symptoms were being exacerbated by sort of perimenopausal or menopausal issues. And of course, it's a phytoestrogen, so it has sort of SERM activity as well that I think might be useful here. Could have used something like black cohosh, but I'd be slightly more concerned about using that with somebody with a history of liver issues there, which is probably why I didn't use black cohosh in that situation.
Was the bowel one of this symptom? What was it? Was the bowel symptom? What's the word? Was the bowel a guide to your management sometimes?
I think so. I mean, looking back to when she was before I saw her, she had recurrent severe constipation, severe burning pain in right hand side of the rib cage, vomiting, transient jaundice, massive raises in all her liver function tests. So she had a severe ADR to morphine, she went into anaphylactic shock with it. But it was that constant nausea, emesis, diarrhea, constipation, mixed transient jaundice that was the issue, and abdominal cramping. So I think that's probably why I was thinking about the Dioscorea there. I think that Matricaria works very well against that sort of gastrointestinal type nausea as well. I think it takes the edge off that slightly, as well as the ginger in the acute mix as well. Yeah.
Now, I do find working in gut-related issues, and that obviously includes the pancreas, one of the more rewarding things, because the gut is so good at telling you where you're going wrong and how to adjust and fine-tune it, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's good for this strategic approach, yeah.
And it's fascinating how sometimes you can go in to a complex condition like this and give a prescription that works first time. And, of course, other times you go in there and you think you're doing. You give it, nothing works. And you spend literally the first sort of 3 months trying to get the right mix of medicine. And then suddenly, eureka, you find a mix that works. And, hey, then everything's fine. But, herbal medicine is definitely a science, but there's a lot of art to it as well.
Absolutely.
We have a lot of herbs to choose from, and it is you know, sometimes, yes, you can use your energetics, you can use your phytochemistry to try and work out what's right. But sometimes you have to work, you know, excuse the pun, on your gut feeling and choose the herb that you think is right for that particular person. Some people, you can just see that there's some, you know, there's some degree of, you know, they can see an overlap between them and some herb. And you know, that sounds very wishy-washy, I know, but there is that association that comes to mind when you see them.
Yeah, I mean, the point I was going to follow through there is that, you know, for those new in practice or students or whatever listening to this thinking this is an appallingly difficult challenge, that if you're working with the gut, it will often be your best guide. And even if you don't have that magic first luck with your first hunch, you can usually keep at it until something does begin to work. If you just go, keep at it.
Exactly. And I think, you know, if you're in doubt where to start sometimes with gut issues, I always go in there with chamomile tea and a probiotic, because, you know, you can do many a thing with a probiotic, a prebiotic, which chamomile is a wonderful prebiotic in tea form. And just,
I will sometimes invite would-be patients to start with teas even before they come in, so that they can give me some information.
Yeah,
and they do as to which seems to suit them better.
Absolutely. I think, and it is important to hear the feedback from patients as well, what they find, what they think's working for them. You know, the body, as we all know, has a lot of inner wisdom that we tend to try and ignore and filter out.
Yeah.
And getting patients to listen to and, you know, repeat that wisdom to us, it tells us a lot about what's going on and what they may need. And I always think, you know, with these complex conditions, it's a bit like peeling an onion. Yes. Often you go in, your first prescriptions take off the first layer, then there's a very slightly different layer underneath. So you have to change things a little bit, then there's another layer, another layer, another layer, until you get to the real heart of what's going on there. And that is what you need to work at, to get to that heart, to really change the underlying cause that's causing the disease, because the disease is just a symptom, isn't it? It's realistically, we need to look about what the underlying cause is that's manifesting as a disease.
Yes, I see the symptoms as a signpost pointing to the work that needs to be done. But I think this is one first thing to mark down as what differentiates us from the conventional medical thing, is that we are listening at every level. We're listening to the cacophony of symptoms to work out what's going on underneath, but we're also inviting the patient to listen and to pass on that information, which is a luxury we can have because we spend the time with the patient, and doctors don't have that luxury. And of course, we can argue they don't actually ask the right questions either, because they're interested in, you know, what have I got for pancreatitis? End of.
Exactly. And that is a wonderful resource we have, that time to talk to and listen to a patient. As you said, you know, doctors don't have that. All the doctors I know are absolutely so jealous of me, because I spend about 90 minutes with a patient generally for the first time. Yeah. And, you know, often patients will say to me, that's the first time I've been able to be talked to about, I've been able to talk about this to somebody, and I feel I've been listened to.
And the story's unravelling.
Exactly. And you could just see when they leave the consultation room, they've walked in all kind of like, you know, despondent, a bit low. They walk up upright, and, you know, you could just see their vitality has increased just by being able to talk and offload. And
absolutely.
Yes, yeah. is that sort of part of the placebo effect? Well, yes, it probably is. But, you know, if it's making somebody better, it doesn't matter what you call it. It is that first step in getting that patient back to normal, full health again, which is what we want. Yeah.
I've always defined placebo as evidence of self-healing.
Exactly.
It doesn't need much of a nudge to get it underway, and it's definitely core of why practice is to bolster that up as much as possible. So, very good. First step, I think we've got room for one or two more stories.
Okay. Well, how about another really complex condition, this one not associated with cancer at all. This is an autoimmune disease. So in my practice, I see obviously a lot of cancer patients. I do see a lot of autoimmune patients as well, because I do feel there's a lot of, actually, controversially, a lot of overlap between cancer and autoimmune disease.
There is,
in the fact there's a lot of immune system dysregulation, inappropriate inflammatory markers going around. And strange enough, I also see a lot of chronic fatigue as well. And I think that fits into the same triad as well. I see them as all three very interconnected, and usual similar herbs used in all have very good effects. But, you know, it's some of my doctor friends might pull me up on that as I couldn't prove that, but I really feel that greatly. So this was, again, a very complex case. Any autoimmune case, I think, really bite a fork is a complex case because there are so many different factors that lead to the autoimmune disease development, and it's always specific for that absolute singular patient. So that's when the need to have a very thorough, in-depth probing consultation and a very supportive therapeutic relationship, I think, is essential, because you need to really learn from the patient what has caused this, you know, and that's when the doctors haven't got the time to do that, and they don't look at the cause again. They're just looking at the symptom, which is the autoimmune effect. So this patient was a 60-year-old professional woman. She'd suddenly came down with jaundice, was checked out, LFTs, liver function tests through the roof. Doctors kind of didn't know what was going on for a start. Lots of sort of different scans, MRI, CTs, etc. Couldn't find very much apart from enlargement of the liver. So they had to go in and do a biopsy, which is not the most pleasant thing. And of course, that showed immediately autoimmune hepatitis. A patient was put onto the usual protocol of the steroids. I think it was budenicide for a short time, and then moved on to, I think it's azathioprine. Azathioprine, sorry. And, and things started to get better, but her liver function test really didn't go back to normal, and she was still feeling rather unwell, nausea, recurrent UTIs, redness on face. She felt very puffed up, she said. And she wanted some help from me to support her going through the conventional treatment, which I was very happy to do. You know, obviously, we know the steroids are lifesavers, but their side effects are quite severe, and the same with the azathioprine. It's absolutely essential, but you know it does have side effects. So you know, I had a chat with her consultant, her GI consultant, and he was okay for me to use herbs. He said, as long as you're not going to tell the patient to stop all the medication. I said, no, I work in an integrated way, so I'm there to support the patient and to support you in what you're doing. I work with you. I'm not working against you here. And so, you know, I told him what I was going to suggest. I gave some supplements, and I actually gave her a tincture, which I know is a bit controversial in somebody with liver issues, but I thought the tincture was actually the best way of getting a diverse number of herbs into her that I couldn't get in a tea or tablet form. So I gave her a mix of some of my favourite herbs here. Again, very much herbs that will be dear to you and to Kerry. But astragalus, milk vetch, buplurum, hare's ear root, hemidesmus, Indian sarsaparilla, which is a wonderful immunomodulator stroke immunosuppressant that's useful, I find, for autoimmune disease. Some Chinese foxglove, Romania, some feverfew, tanacetum, parthenium, and some ginger. And, I actually didn't put any, as you'll notice, particular major liver supporters in there, but I did put her on a milk thistle supplement to take separately, just as a bit of extra support. And I actually got her to get a GP to check her thyroid function. And actually, because, you know, obviously with autoimmune disease, it can quite commonly affect the thyroid as well. And I felt some of her fatigue issues she was having weren't necessarily drug-related, but might be thyroid-related. And indeed, her thyroid was on the lower side of normal, so she was bordering towards hypothyroidism. So I actually put her on a thyroid support tablet made by a well-known herbal manufacturer who I won't mention. And she's done really well on this. She's really thrived. She's been on this now since, let's just find some dates, since 2020. Her liver function tests have all gone back to normal. She's been able to drop the budenicide. She's reduced the dose of the azathioprine right down to low dose, and everything is absolutely normal. And we're hoping over the next sort of time period to reduce the azathioprine completely. And she's stayed in a very similar formula, and it just works very well. I do find that the mix of the Dermania, the feverfew, the buplurum, and the hemidesmus worked very, very well together in this sort of,
on the immunological front, yes.
Yeah, it's really looking to retrain the immune system just to ignore self. And I think that will take time.
I mean, you said you gave milk thistle as a supplement. You know, the first thought would be, oh, I must give liver remedies for this. But you're right, aren't you, that to identify the liver as the target rather than the it's the immunological disruption that we need to focus on in a story like this.
But it's kind of a bit daunting going into an autoimmune case, I think, because you just don't know where to start sometimes.
Mm.
But it's just going back, I think, to the first principles, and I just say you're looking to really look at the immune system, inflammation, microbiome, of course. Obviously,
I mean, it comes back to the liver and gut anyway, but obviously you need to tackle the mechanism as well as you can.
Absolutely. So, you know, and you know, she's still taking medicine for me. She's still thriving. So that's really good. And her consultant is really happy. And you know, I think there's a lot of herbalists who see consultants as being their kind of enemy, and vice versa. A lot of consultants who see herbalists as their enemy,
especially hepatologists.
Yeah. Well, yeah, exactly.
I mean, you're lucky to find a hepatologist to let you loose on their patients.
Yeah, well, exactly. I think, you know, I would say, I think having a background in research and academia does give you, unfortunately, it's not fair, but it's true, a bit of a stepping stone, because I think then often consultants will take you a bit more seriously because they think, okay, well, he's had some scientific training, so he's not some witchcrafty kook who's standing around their cauldron all day stirring it and adding a few bits of eye of frog and toe of Newton, which I think, you know, that's why it's so important, I think, you know, that we really talk about modern herbalism. I'm not saying against any of the previous practices or other practices and people who do sort of consider themselves, you know, witches, because of course nothing wrong. That powerful people, and a lot of our history is based on that. And I respect completely anybody who wants to call themselves whatever they want to. But it's all about the herbs, isn't it? Primarily the herbal medicines and how they work. That's the important thing.
People can come at this in all sorts of directions.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I think, you know, we've got such a diverse practitioner base, you know, and that's wonderful. That's one of the strengths, because, you know, different patients work well with different people, and we need that variety in order to cater for all the patients available. And I always get slightly concerned and upset when some practitioners are quite sort of protective about their own sort of area. There's plenty of patients to go around. I don't think we're ever going to run out of patients to go around. And, you know, the more practitioners you have in an area seeing patients, the more word of mouth interest is going to be, and the more patients are going to come to those practitioners. So I think we have to see the bigger picture there. And the same consultants, I actually get some referrals, or, well, not referrals, because doctors aren't allowed to refer, but they recommend patients come and see me for supportive measures, you know. And I find that quite reassuring. I think the patient finds that reassuring as well.
Yeah. It's often they start with their families and work from there.
Exactly.
I see my spouse here.
Hi there, Sebastian here. If you're enjoying this episode, you might like to know there are plenty more herbal insights on our website. Come and discover more on the science, tradition, and practical use of herbs at herbalreality.com. You can check out our special features such as our Herb Library, where we have monographs written by clinical practitioners on over 200 herbs used in Western, Chinese and Ayurvedic herbal traditions. We cover the traditional use, modern research, how practitioners use the herbs in clinic, any quality and safety data, as well as a sustainability listing, so you know how to safely use the best quality herbs in a way that protects your health and that of the planet. You can search herbs by the action, grouping them all together, say for immunity or by energetic function, all the immunological, heating or cooling herbs in one place. You can also sign up for our newsletter for plant-powered wisdom delivered straight to your inbox for the most up-to-date information. Right, let's get back to today's conversation.
Yes, well, again, illuminating. And, you know, you're touching on an important point that so often in our practice we're dealing with people in the throes of their conventional treatment, and how do we navigate that? You know, one approach is, you know, to turn your back on it, which can work for some people in some situations, but so often you do have to work around with what else is going on without wrecking the boat. Yeah, so thank you for that illustration as well. Still looking good on time, Chris. I don't know if you can roll up your sleeves and get us with another story.
Well, I think you mentioned about working with oncologists, which can be quite complex at times, because a lot of them don't have any training at all in anything. Well, as most doctors don't, in nutrition or diet or herb medicine wise. So some, particularly the older school, will just say no to everything. No, don't take it. We don't know what it does. But I do find that some oncologists of the older generation and some of the more younger ones are much more open minded, because they're seeing, you know, and hearing about some of the research that's coming through. You know, a lot of doctors will say, well, there's no research to support herbal medicine. Simon, you know as well as I do, that's really not the case. There's some very good research coming through. It's not the 10,000 RCT, of course, because we can't afford that, but we're getting sort of 100, 1,000 RCTs, which is really kind of quite good quality research. You know, there's been the wonderful research, you know, on echinacea recently and reducing antibiotic use, and, you know, cranberry in preventing UTIs. That's just really adds to our credibility. But, you know, yeah, oncologists are, obviously hugely highly trained consultants. I respect them greatly, but they just often say no rather than anything else, which is challenging. But, you know, I do like to take time to work with them if I can, if they will listen to me, and I will send them information. And there is, you know, lots of information available I can send to them. Is it getting them to read? That is kind of difficult, as they always say, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it drink. But, you know, what you can do is provide the information there. And, you know, obviously, I always say it's up to the patient to decide what they do and want to do. It's patient-centered medicine these days. And, you know, the oncologist or any consultant should take that into account, what the patient wants as well as what they want for the patient.
Yeah, they've stopped bullying them quite so much, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, this is strangely enough, because I don't just deal with gastrointestinal issues, but this is a patient who had cholangiocarcinoma, and I was supporting her with surgery for that, because obviously it was quite extensive surgery she had to have for removal of everything around there, then the gallbladder removed, a lot of the ducts removed, etc. And so I gave her, you know, I saw her before surgery, so I gave her a supportive mix to help her recover before surgery, and of course with the important caveat to stop everything at least 7 days before surgery, so there's no risk of interference with the anesthesia or blood coagulation, etc., etc. And then to start that as soon as possible afterwards. So it was a usual sort of mix of things like common stuff we'd use to aid healing: centella, echinacea, eleutherococcus, I find particularly useful. A bit of phytolacca, which I think just does wonders in that situation. Some gingiber. I tend to use thuja as well, because I think that works very well on the immune side as well as everything else within the dose limits, of course. And she recovered really, really well from the surgery. She had some pain afterwards. She had some liver issues afterwards. So I put on a liver mix there with a lot of...
How much gut had she had removed?
She had quite a lot of the sort of duodenum area removed. So, you know, and the gallbladder. And I, you know, I think that they didn't take any of the pancreas, but I think they had to scrape off some of the pancreas. So it caused...
The stomach was intact, and it was just a shortcut to the small intestine. Yeah.
Exactly. So it was quite disruptive. But her liver really was very disturbed by this all. Of course, I mean, it had gallbladder removed. So, you know, so she, I gave her some nice liver support afterwards there with some, you know, a tincture which had things, you know, like milk thistle, strangely enough. And I gave her a nice little sleep mix, which is, this is back in 2008. So I kind of, it's interesting as a very strange. I wouldn't use this sleep mix now, but it was Galsemium, Hypericum, Lavangula, Matricaria, Passiflora, Pisidia, Pulsatilla, Scutellaria, and Dibop, which is kind of like a mountain of herbs in a sleep mix. But hey, it did work. And I gave her a wonderful inflammatory pain cream to use topically over the area, which is an Arnica, Galsemium, Hypericum, Lobelia, comfrey root and wintergreen essential oil, which again worked very well. So she worked through this very well, really, until a couple of years afterwards, when she started to actually develop really terrible griping, spasming pains and real massive reductions in her blood sugar to a huge level, which was causing her a lot of issues. And so I put on another mix here, which was interesting, again, so Buplurum, Dioscorea, Glycyrrhiza, Panax ginseng, Viburnum op, and Zingiber officinale, and that seemed to work quite well. She carried on some sleep mixes. As time got by, the pain kind of went in cycles. She'd have good times and bad times. It was always at night time it affected her.
Was the pain coming from the gut?
It was the gut. It was definitely around about the liver area, with cramping associated around there. So it got better and then it got worse. So she had some exploratory laparoscopic and gastroscopic and colonoscopic investigations. Couldn't find anything wrong at all. So I think they kind of figured they may have grazed some of the nerves that supply the pancreas that might have affected pancreatic function. But her insulin levels were normal and they weren't sure what was causing this really massive sort of reduction in blood sugars sometimes, which was a bit problematic for her. But I changed her mix slightly, her main mix. I didn't say hypericin just as a general anti-inflammatory rather than anything else. And I added some sort of a datura into a sleep mix. I can't remember why, probably just as an antispasmodic on the gut.
Yeah, antispasmodic on the gut, too.
Yeah, yes. Inotropa at the time, maybe. And, you know, moving on, I've been working at this, I said, really since 2008, I think it was. So she still has to have her medicine. She doesn't take it. Again, she's just has really poor problems with sleep and with pain generally and blood sugar going down. But just looking at her current mix, she has a digestive support mix, which after lots of playing around, and this is one of these conditions that, you know, where it's complex, you have to fiddle around a lot to find the right mix of herbs, and then suddenly everything fits into place. So currently she's on a bigger prescription for a main mix that I normally give, but it works. So it's Angelica Archangelica, Atropa Belladonna Herba, Citrus Reticulata, so 10P, which is, you know, a wonderful Chinese herb medicine that works really well in this condition. Dried orange peel extract. Cynara scolymus, so globe artichoke, not surprising there, perhaps, for its bitter and sort of hepatotrophic restorative effects. Menta piperita, which I think is wonderful as well. I've actually got some parietaria and judaica in there as well, pellitory of the wall, and that was because the kidney function was going down a little bit, and I do find that's a wonderful kidney trophy restorative, and some zingiber as well in there. I also have an acute pain mix, which is, this is not for the faint-hearted, it's a mix of atropa, Corydalis, Galsemium, Lobelia, and ginger. So you couldn't fit many more Schedule 20s
that
in.
That would knock out an ox. Yeah.
If you want to, it works, and she swears by it. She, you know, it just knocks the pain on the head and gets rid of it, which nothing else does. Paracetamol, Cocodamol, Tramadol, nothing else hits it. This does. Again, because I think we're really hitting it from different directions in the pain inflammatory pathways. And I've also got her on...
You've talked about pain relief a couple of times now, which is quite a big hill for some practitioners to climb. You know, how do you manage pain? Can we compete with the usual analgesics? And you're saying very clearly from your experience that, yes, you can. You have to sometimes bite the bullet and rattle nettle or whatever the illusion is and put in some sometimes quite strong and Schedule 20 stuff as well, obviously, which is something that we can do, but you can't generally advise people, thankfully, to do on their own.
Thank goodness, absolutely, yes.
Yeah, because some of them are fairly challenging. You mentioned poke back a while. What's your feeling about poke root as a remedy? I mean, dose-wise or impact-wise?
I would say it's one of my favourite herbs to use. It's a very pokey herb, not, no pun intended. Yes. It can often sort things out with nothing else well.
Yes, I find that. Yeah.
I think we have to be cautious with dose. So there's a level of dosage we have to sort of move to there. I don't use more than 5 mils.
Our supplier doesn't provide it anything more than 200 mil bottles anymore.
Tiny bottles, absolutely. Exactly, just to make sure. But, I know that the indication is short-term use only. I find long-term use is fine, you know.
Yeah, my American colleagues, when I was teaching over there, used to willy-nilly. I was shocked at how widely they used it from the native traditions, of course.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I think it's that wisdom of the Native Americans is so important in my practice. I think it's some of the herbs I use. I really am so thankful for the knowledge that lets me use those herbs, quite frankly.
But you're quite right. I mean, it can be double-sided, double-edged. Sometimes when I'm dealing with a complex, particularly if it's immunological inflammatory, and you're hitting a wall and you just add a little frisson of poke, It can break through, can't it?
It can. It's a wonderful herb. You know, it just has so many different actions, not just on the lymphatic system and it's anti-inflammatory, and has a whole wealth of other actions as well. And it does, as you say, I think it has that activating effect that just, it really synergizes well with other herbs and just gets them where they're needed, I think.
Just breaks through the envelope. Yeah.
It does. It really does. And I do use it. I use it a lot, obviously, in my cancer patients, surprisingly enough, because obviously they need a lot of lymphatic support. And it just really, really works well. And I think I've seen some brilliant situations where there's been lymph node involvement with cancer patients. And, you know, just by giving pocolone, and, you know, it's really taken down the size of a lymph node and removed disease from there in conjunction with everything else they're doing. I'm not saying it's just the poke, but the poke made a difference in treatment. And I think it's a wonderful, you know, adjunct to integrated treatment poke. It works so well. I love it.
So another wider question, you know, while we're into these complex situations, and you alluded to earlier on about using tinctures, sometimes when people are very sick, they find it very difficult to take our herbs, don't they? So one thought is, you know, you put hot water in with your tinctures to boil off the alcohol or blast off the alcohol, or you use teas, which I know you know quite a lot about teas as well, as a way of titrating the dose up, starting with teas. And I mean, can you talk us through some of the ways in which you navigate these challenges with people who find their herbs too strong?
Yeah, I mean, I think I would generally say my patients are pretty compliant. I would say generally, women better than men. I think we all find that in practice. Men can be a bit sort of a baby sometimes about strong tastes. But yeah, I mean, obviously, some patients don't like the taste. They don't like the alcohol. So I do as you say. I tell them to either add to juice, which works in some cases, and for children as well, that works well. Or yes, you add to hot water, where some of the alcohol will evaporate away. I mean, not much. And I think that's more of a just the patient thinking the alcohol goes, and hey ho, it doesn't. But the symptoms.
Well, I just say, well, alcohol boils at 78 and not water at 100. So if you hit it above 78, you're going to lose some alcohol. As you say, it's enough to deflect concern.
Get rid of some of it, absolutely. I think I think often patients, some of the ones who really think the alcohol is causing a problem, suddenly that things are much better if they do that. So, you know, there we go.
Another one, again, from my American friends, you know, who sometimes have problems with the alcohol in their various state licenses. So and the cost, as you may know, over there, the cost of tinctures is extraordinarily high, and they sell them in dropper doses as well. So to get any dose up, they use powders.
Yeah. And that could work well. I mean, I do use powders, and some of the powdered extracts, I think, are very, very good. You know, and then I think, you know, inherently, particularly for patients, when you've got to watch them with the risk of infection, if their immune system is down, obviously, because they're extracts, that they're going to be bacteria-free, which is, you know, something we can't always...
You need to do decoctions or infusions for them.
Yeah, exactly. So, yes, I will use extracts in, you know, granular form or powdered form. Yeah, I can. I will use that. And, you know, obviously that's something that's particularly very commonly used in Ayurveda as a practice, which I think the wisdom there is millennia old. So, you know, who are we to ignore that? But, you know, I find, you know, I do work with palliative care for patients as well. And, you know, I do find then generally tinctures are the best bet, because that they can often, patients then will just take a shot neat.
Certainly the most convenient.
Exactly. And it's fine. Whereas often if they're bedbound, particularly teas probably would be a better route. But they don't want to be constantly having to get out of bed to go to the loo or have their bags changed, etc. So, you know, I do tend to go towards tinctures there. Tablets as well, if they can swallow tablets. You know, that we have a range of very good quality tablets available to us, which can tackle a number of different conditions.
And especially in support, yes.
Yeah, and capsules as well. Obviously, you can get some of those made up with the extracts that I think are very, very powerful. But yeah, I mean, teas, I think, are really important. We overlook teas a lot, I think, and teas can be very effective. And you know, a number of conditions, particularly obviously urinary tract issues, I will always, always, always use a herbal tea as well as a tincture. And sometimes I'll just use a herbal tea. So somebody with recurrent UTIs, I'll give them a cranberry capsule tablet to take, but I'd always give them a very similar, a general anyway, tea with things like, you know, buku, marshmallow leaf, meadow sweet, horsetail, corn silk, German chamomile I find works very well. And Antilia, lime flower, yes. I find yes. works very, very well because it has that slight mucilaginous quality because it's a member of the mallow family, but it has that wonderful nervine tonic effect as well, which I think is really important there. And patients love those teas because anything in Bukuin just tastes absolutely delicious. But they drink that. And I mean, I have them drinking it 6-8 times a day, you know, with 2 teaspoons each time. And it, you know, quite mega sort of doses of the herb.
It works particularly well for kidney and urinary function too, isn't it? Yes.
It really does. So yeah. I'm a big fan of herbal teas.
Yeah. Well, we can do a plug for spring 2026. The CPP, our professional body, is running a tea workshop, isn't it? We haven't got dates yet, but
yeah. We'll be around about March the 15th, 16th. We'll be having a seminar talking all about all things tea. So lots of research for sort of not just herbal teas, but black tea as well, but talking about all the benefits of herbal teas and what they can do. And we'll have sort of a workshop with tea tasting of some of our common herbs and maybe some of the herbs we don't use so much, like roselle, hibiscus saptifera, which are one of my favourite tea herbs there, which has a wealth of wonderful research looking at its cardiovascular activity. Yes. Hypotensive activity, a great herb, it really is.
Well, this has been great. And the time has actually run on and on and on, and we've actually covered a lot of ground. And I think the thing that is impressive about conversations like this is how diverse and adaptable the herbal approaches are. You know, and you've touched on that very well. We've got different methods, we've got different approaches, we've got ways of thinking strategically. You know, and it puts a lie to the idea that herbs is just for wishy-washy things, you know, that doctors think, well, I'll give it to a herbalist because it's probably functional, it's probably, you know, psychosomatic or whatever. As you are illustrating, we can really do real business with the herbs. So thank you so much for taking us through that. It's really been, I hope, for everybody, informative.
Well, thank you, Simon. Chris. It's been wonderful talking to you today. It's such a wonderful thing we do with herbal medicine, and I think we should all be singing and shouting about it. You know, in the past, I think we've always been quite apologetic about it, not us, but other people, and kept in the dark a little bit. I think we need to really, really get out there what we're doing and what we can do to support patients, particularly at a time when the NHS is really struggling. Absolutely. We can do a lot to help, you know, both primary and secondary care to reduce footfall, and I think we should be doing that, and I think the government should be supporting us in that.
Well, to your credit, you've been doing more than anybody else in getting that message out, Chris. So we thank you for many times over and for this session too.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Herbcast from Herbal Reality. We hope today's conversation has planted a seed of inspiration and deepened your understanding of herbal medicine, even answered a question or two. Please do subscribe to Herbcast wherever you're listening to this right now, and you'll be sure to never miss an episode. If you've enjoyed today's conversation, we'd love you to give us a 5-star rating and share it with someone who'd enjoy it too. As they say, learn something, teach something. It really helps us to reach more people and spread the good herbal world. You can also use a podcast review to share your comments and feedback about Herbcast, or perhaps make a suggestion for a future episode. It's always great to hear your views. If you can't wait till the next episode, you'll find plenty more herbal insights and all the previous Herbcast episodes on our website and, of course, on social media. All the links you need are in the episode show notes. Until next time, take care and thanks again for joining us for another episode of Herbcast from Herbal Reality. Bye for now.